Peter Mudd, November 30th, 1990, Jung and the Split Feminine.
We're on? Okay. Good evening. I'm Betty Jorum, president of the Jung Society. I see a lot of familiar faces, and it's a pleasure to welcome you this evening to the last of our fall series of presentations. As you know, tonight's presenter is Peter Mudd, and he's going to be talking to you about Jung and the Anima, the Split Feminine. He's a Jungian analyst in private practice in Chicago and a consultant. He's also the executive director of the C.G. Jung Institute of Chicago Analyst Training Program and the editor of International Abstracts of Analytical Psychology and associate editor of the Journal of Analytical Psychology. And tonight his presentation is on Jung and the Anima. Welcome, Peter.
Can you hear me all right through this? Yes? Okay. It's nice to be, I can say, back in Seattle. About 15 years ago, I lived with my wife down the coast in Astoria, Oregon. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Astoria, but it's a tough place to live. And we used to come up here just about every weekend to visit friends, so it was a place of salvation. And when I came in on the plane today and saw Seattle, which is different from the way it was 15 years ago, I felt a little bit like I was coming home, so it's nice to be here. To give you a little bit of background on this paper, it was really born originally in Berlin, in Germany. And I was asked in 1986 to respond to a paper that was being given at the International Conference on Analytical Psychology by an analyst named Aldo Carotenuto. Some of you may know his work. He wrote a book called The Secret Symmetry, and some of what I'll talk about deals with the triangle that he described in that book between or among Freud, Sabine Spielrein, and Jung. And then when I came back, I only got 20 minutes to do it in Berlin, so when I came back, I've worked on it some more, and it had a life in Detroit and one in Brazil last year. So that'll give you some idea of the time frame and the geographies that have contributed to the paper. Now, many of us who have an interest in Jungian ideas have, I'm sure, privately speculated on the content and the intensity of the shadow of C.G. Jung. But to publicly reveal privately held analytical insights regarding the ego ideal collectively revered by one's community is disconcerting, to say the least. To venture even further into a critique of theory based on those insights will seem to some bordering on blasphemy. But in my own defense, I can invoke Jung himself and cite his own statements that theory, including his own, is always a subjective confession, and that all his ideas were always considered tentative and awaited further elaboration. My comments in this paper, which is brief, really, probably be somewhere around 45 minutes, are divided into three parts. The first section deals with the origin of a deeply split so-called feminine element in Jung and what Jung termed his polygamous components, especially as they manifested themselves in relation to Sabine Spielrein, Toni Wolff, and Emma Jung, and other individual women, among whom could be counted Helle Preisswerk, who was Jung's cousin and the subject of his doctoral dissertation, Babette S., who was the subject of the Psychology of Dementia Precox, which was Jung's landmark work on schizophrenia, which was the first psychoanalytic interpretation of schizophrenia, a woman named Miss Frank Miller, who was the subject of the book now known as Symbols of Transformation, and Christiana Morgan, who was the subject of Jung's vision seminars. The second section deals with the aspect of power in Jung's interpersonal and intrapsychic life. And the last is a section describing the crossover between Jung's personal experience with women and theoretical aspects concerning, in quotes, the so-called feminine. I'm strongly convinced that Jung's theory of an intelligent, compensatory unconscious, if not his most important theoretical idea, was very close to it. In this concept, Jung's notion of the self and its relentless drive for realization, what we now call individuation, speak to the utter necessity for wholeness, balance, and an ego that can stand the driving pressure of the self. Through many readings of the two essays on analytical psychology, probably the book which most systematically lays out Jung's system, but throughout the many readings of that set of essays in all their various revisions, I've been continually impressed by one statement, and this is a quote by Jung. "A collapse of the conscious attitude is no small thing. It always feels like the end of the world, as though everything had tumbled back into original chaos. One feels delivered up, disoriented, like a rudderless ship that is abandoned to the moods of the elements. So at least it seems. In reality, however, one has fallen back on the collective unconscious, which now takes over the leadership." Unquote. It's paragraph 254 for the obsessional people in the group. This powerful and poignant utterance could very easily have been a description of what Jung experienced first in his relationship with Sabina Spielrein and again in his loss of Freud. To me, it also describes the seemingly demonic, destructive, dark side of the self, which ruthlessly enforces the law of compensation by sweeping aside all our most cherished constructions, weavings, and collages, whose combination we call ego identity. As you may know, if you've read the book I referred to already, The Secret Symmetry by Aldo Cartenuto, you'll know that Sabina Spielrein was a patient of Jung's at the Burgholzli Asylum in Zurich. She was hospitalized at age 19 for serious psychotic episodes, and Jung's treatment of her was quite successful. In fact, he described it in a letter to Freud as his unstinting effort. In those early days of psychoanalytic treatment, the concept countertransference, or the analyst's emotional reactions to the analysand, did not even exist. And Jung, during the course of his work with Spielrein, in essence, fell deeply in love with her. Cartenuto described this love as psychotic countertransference, and I would agree with that characterization. In fact, Jung's episode with Spielrein may be the point of origin for the concept countertransference altogether. Freud, who was Jung's confidant in this matter, began to speak of the concept shortly after Jung had written to him about the situation. Now, just as a means of a little bit of background, we need to remember that Jung had been married to Emma Rauschenbach for about 1 year when he met Spielrein. But discontent quickly grew in that marriage, and it was a key factor in instigating the relationship with Spielrein. Emma Jung became pregnant almost immediately after the marriage, and so Jung was propelled into a family life that he probably was not ready for. Jung, in letters to Spielrein, expressed his contempt with bourgeois social conventions and openly confessed to her a longing for liberation from their limitations. Nonetheless, he never left his marriage, and it is still not definitely known if his relationship with Spielrein was sexually consummated. The fact that Jung never would leave his wife supports the contention that I'll make, that Jung needed to be related to different women who embodied different aspects of his so-called feminine side, a split feminine, and that the element embodied by Emma Jung was clearly the most critical in maintaining Jung's psychological balance. The Jung-Spielrein relationship spanned over about 10 years, but the romantic phase was ended after about 7 years. Sabina Spielrein, in many ways, was an embodiment of an element of Jung's personality and carried his unconscious projection for years, believing that Jung might actually leave his wife for her. This same fate would later befall Tony Wolfe, and Emma Jung would suffer through both of these and perhaps other projective adventures. Spielrein, Wolfe, and Emma Jung were, in my opinion, carriers of psychological aspects of C.G. Jung's so-called feminine side, which I am characterizing as the split feminine. It is a remarkably ironic synchronicity that Spielrein's major theoretical contribution, because Spielrein, as you may know, went on to become a medical doctor and a practicing psychoanalyst, and just as this paper is gossipy, so I'll throw in a little bit more gossip. Spielrein was actually Jean Piaget's first analyst, so if you're interested in those kinds of things, there you go. So her major theoretical contribution, whose creation paralleled her relationship with Jung, was entitled, in quote, "Destruction as a Cause of Becoming." For a part of her was also destroyed in this relationship, which was also so healing for her. Another aside on this is that this essay that Spielrein wrote, which has never been translated into English, was essentially a paper which introduced the concept of the death instinct, which Freud was later to pick up in the early 1920s in the book Beyond the Pleasure Principle. And Freud, unfortunately, does not cite Spielrein, but Spielrein presented this paper to the Vienna Circle. And at that time, Freud's comment on it was that it was sort of interesting, but he sort of dismissed it. He seemed to have gotten interested in it later because he basically, I think, appropriated the central idea that she had in it. One of my own private opinions about Spielrein is that a major incongruity in her relationship with Jung was that she had already learned through her psychosis something of what it means to die, while Jung's sense of death remained entirely on a symbolic level. I believe that Spielrein's psychotic experience, healed in great measure by Jung's skills and his erotic countertransference, initiated her into a dimension of being that Jung was to discover only much later in his own life. Because she had an ego that had died, in essence, and been reborn, she really had something of a psychological edge. She had priorities that reflected a relativized persona and ego, while Jung had not been immersed in that mystery and was, in fact, in many ways, staunchly defended against it. For this reason, Jung and Spielrein were star-crossed lovers whose affair was doomed to an unhappy ending from the start. In keeping with Jung's own statement about the collapse of a conscious attitude, I'd suggest that an inquiry into the construction of that attitude, sometimes called personal history, sometimes psychohistory, sometimes case fiction, or simply projection, would be a useful means of approaching an analysis of the origins of particular concepts in analytical psychology. In simple terms, if we understand the man, we'll understand something essential about the theory. This is for the simple reason that Jung drew extensively, almost exclusively, on his own experiences as a source for theory. Now, this leads me to the more specific comments on the origins of the split feminine in Jung's life. In the paper I mentioned earlier by Kurt Nudo, given in Berlin, it was proposed with convincing evidence that Jung's encounter with Spielrein was an initiation into a profound experience of what he later called the anima and the catalytic source of that theoretical concept. I have no quarrel with that idea. Even so, or perhaps because of this notion, questions occurred to me such as, who was Jung's anima? What was she like? And where did she come from? In exploring these questions, I would like to focus on the evidence present in Jung's autobiography, which enables us to identify personal elements that contributed to the development of the anima as a theoretical concept. Jung, in a letter to Freud about Spielrein, identified within himself what he termed his, quote, polygamous components, unquote. I would like to suggest that Jung's polygamous dimension, which characterized his adult relations with women, was an attempt to heal a deep and troubling split in his own mother imago, which began in his turbulent relationship with his mother. This personal experience and its vicissitudes would later be generalized theoretically as the anima concept. By Jung's own report, we know that his parents' marriage was deeply troubled. Not too many people know that the first son of this couple, named Paul Achilles Jung Jr., died shortly after birth. And it could be surmised that the death of this child was a factor in their marital discord and in the depressions which plagued Jung's mother, and probably also in Jung's mother's tendency to really aggrandize him and to imagine him in rather inflated and grandiose terms. If you know the autobiography, you know some of the very problematic statements that Jung's mother made to him and about him. During his early life, Jung himself was sickly, and we can find in these illnesses evidence to support the idea that Jung's earliest sense of self was one of discomfort, struggle, and weakness, surrounded by the atmosphere of an unstable, inconsistent environment. By the time Jung was 3, his mother had been psychiatrically hospitalized for a profound depression, and his own words report his experience of that event. This is a quote from Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. "I was deeply troubled by my mother's being away. From then on, I always felt mistrustful when the word love was spoken." And this next line is very crucial. "The feeling I associated with woman for a long time was that of innate unreliability." Unquote. This sense of abandonment by the mother, I believe, left Jung, who already had experienced both physical problems and profound environmental instability, vulnerable to intense death fears. The loss of his mother as an omnipotent protecting object would have excited this panic, and the depth of his sense of despair is pointed out by his own report. This is a quote, also from Memories, Dreams, Reflections. "My mother told me, too, of the time I was crossing the bridge over the Rhine Falls at New Haven. The maid caught me just in time. I had already one leg under the railing and was about to slip through. These things point to an unconscious suicidal urge, or it may be to a fatal resistance to life in this world." Unquote. During his mother's absence, Jung was cared for by a spinster aunt and the maid just mentioned, of whom he said, and I quote, "While my mother was away, our maid too looked after me. I still remember her picking me up and laying my head against her shoulder. She had black hair and an olive complexion and was quite different from my mother. I can see even now her hairline, her throat with its darkly pigmented skin, and her ear. All this seemed to me very strange and yet strangely familiar. It was as though she belonged not to my family, but only to me, as though she were connected in some way with other mysterious things I could not understand. This type of girl later became a component of my anima. The feeling of strangeness she conveyed, and yet of having known her always, was a characteristic of that figure which later came to symbolize for me the whole essence of womanhood." Unquote. This security-shattering loss of the mother, though somewhat compensated by the aunt and the maid, produced, as Jung said, a sense of unreliability about women and can be seen as the origin of the split feminine. On the one hand, woman was experienced as an abandoning, dangerous, unreliable creature. On the other, a reassuring, redemptive figure full of eternal strangeness and wonder. Further, we know that Jung described his mother's personality as divided into personalities number 1 and number 2. The number 1 personality was the typical everyday mother, just a good mom who was a good cook. And Jung describes her as having great animal warmth. And the number 2 mother an uncanny, frightening embodiment of what Jung called the natural mind, who was the subject of anxiety dreams and visions, and the voice in the famous man-eater dream which Jung had at the age of 3. You may remember from Memories, Dreams, and Reflections that Jung talks about a series of visions where he saw his mother coming down the hallway with her head coming off and coming back on, and that strange things would come from her bedroom. Her parents separated, his parents separated and actually had separate bedrooms. So her bedroom was one that was particularly charged with strange feeling. Now, these experiences with women seem to me to embody several polarized components of Jung's mother complex and anima, which an archetype could easily contain, while a flesh and blood human being could contain them either only pathologically or with an extraordinarily conscious dedication to her individuation process. The influence of Jung's self-confessed separation trauma, rescue from death by the anima maid, and subsequent relationship to an unstable, changeable mother, leave us with the distinct impression that his internal image of woman at the time he encountered Sabina Spielrein was fragmented and problematic. In an attempt to cure the innate unreliability associated with such a figure, and to protect his ego from being overwhelmed by the anxiety associated with the negative pole of this complex, it appears that Jung chose to relate primarily and defensively to the number one aspect of his mother and anima on both the intrapsychic and interpersonal levels, while repressing the frightening number two personality who could shake the foundations of ego identity and challenge the so-called reality of everyday experience. In other words, Jung just split this imago in half, repressed one half, and related to the other. Jung, consequently, like all of us, developed a persona in accordance with the self-preservational needs of the ego to remain intact and in control. Emma Rauschenbach, Jung's wife, who's been viewed as a sensation type in Jungian parlance, that means a very practical, factual, detailed kind of person, would have offered safe refuge in her solid embodiment of the mother's number one aspect. Her practicality and attention to the everydayness of living would certainly have reinforced the defenses which Jung had developed in the process of ego consolidation. But because this number one element was limited to the so-called normal dimension of Jung's feminine side and was defensively incomplete, it would essentially bore him. This element of containment provided by Emma Jung's personality structure, and really by her great wealth, because Emma Jung was quite a wealthy person in her own right. She was the daughter of a well-known Swiss industrialist, and Jung, as you may know, came from much poorer roots. And when he married Emma Rauschenbach, he married a great deal of financial security at the same time. So the element of containment provided by Emma Jung's personality structure and wealth eventually proved, nonetheless, to be only a temporary defense against the dark self, whose intention was to ensure a destiny for Jung quite different from the one he himself had in mind. It might help you to know that at this time in Jung's life, he was sort of a hot prospect and an up-and-coming psychiatric star in Europe. He had developed the word association studies. His research was circulating throughout Europe. And his ambition at that particular point in time was to teach at the university level. And that was his trajectory at that particular point in time. Now, the earliest public manifestations of the compensatory movement, which sought to balance Jung's defensive preference for a number one lifestyle, can be located in his fascination with the occult and his staunch defense of the vitalist doctrine of spiritual primacy in his Zofingia lectures delivered to his fraternity. This is a very strange group of lectures that Jung gave as a young man, probably between the ages of 21 and 24. And at that particular time in science in Europe, there were two schools, the vitalist school and the materialist school. The Vitalist school took the position that all life was a manifestation of the spirit. And the Materialist school took the exact opposite point of view, that all life was just the result of chemical interactions, and the spirit was an empty, hollow concept. So Jung was very much, as you might imagine, in the Vitalist corner of this. And you can see in this Vitalist-Materialist split the foreshadowing of the Freud-Jung difference, because Freud was trained as a neurologist in the Materialist philosophical school. And so Freud was always basing things in biology and physiology, where Jung was coming from a religious background as the son of a parson, as a rural, slightly bumpkinish type who was steeped in local mythology and superstition and so on. So in the same spirit, his doctoral dissertation, which was called The Pathology of the So-Called Occult Phenomenon, in its attempt to analyze his cousin Helly Priceberg's mediumistic experiences in a rational, quasi-Freudian manner, these things could be partially viewed as defensive intellectualization, seeking to control the powerful forces of the collective unconscious, which his own and his mother's number two personalities embody. The point I'm making here is simply that when you repress something, it has a tendency to come at you in a way that you don't expect. And so Jung's fascination with the occult was really symptomatic, if you will, of this need to integrate this crazier part of his own so-called feminine side, the part of his experience with his mother that he really couldn't integrate very well. Jung's cousin was, in my opinion, among the first projective carriers of the compensatory anima who would ensure his fateful plunge into the archetypal depths. As we know from his autobiography, Jung cited his female patients as those who precipitated his most fruitful discoveries, a fact which supports this thesis of the number two personality being projected into women, who could be considered unstable and fascinating, yet controlled at the same time by the inequality of the analytic relationship or by their being subjects of research. The famous Babette, who Freud found so ugly, I don't know if you know that story of Freud and Jung taking a tour of the Burghölzli when Freud came to Zurich, and Jung took him on rounds, and they came upon Babette, who was Jung's patient, who was the person who I said was the subject of the essay, The Psychology of Dementia Praecox, and Jung was waxing on and on about how interesting she was, and Freud's only comment about her was, she's so ugly, how could you have bared to look at her for so long? And Jung says he was shocked by that response. But Babette, who fascinated and enchanted Jung with her symbolic inner life and language, is another manifestation of this anima element. Now, the need for conscious reintegration of the conflicted and split apart elements of the mother imago and the anima occupied a major portion of Jung's energy for the greater part of his life and clearly contributed to the development of major theoretical ideas. I believe he came to a profound and much clearer understanding of this problem when he experienced a near-death experience in 1944 when he had a massive heart attack. The split feminine and its intimate association with the dread of and protection from death, which had plagued Jung and had instigated the polygamous impulses, in essence became a moot point. Death convinces us that we are separate units of being, no matter what attachments we have contrived or created. The essay on the psychology of the transference, published in 1946, it was probably the first thing published after his heart attack, with its rosarium alchemical pictures illustrating merger states in transference-countertransference phenomena, can be understood as Jung's recognition and delineation of his own process of realizing his separate status. In noting the definite prominence given to anima phenomenon and the dedication of the essay in quotes to my wife, the essay is also obviously a confession and an explanation of Jung's infidelities to Emma Jung. When coupled with a then-increasing estrangement from Tony Wolfe, his mistress of over 30 years, the essay clearly evidences an intense transformation in Jung himself. As he states in his essay on marriage, and I quote, "A dissociation is not healed by being split off, but by more complete disintegration. All the powers that strive for unity, all healthy desire for selfhood, will resist the disintegration. And in this way, he will become conscious of an inner integration, which before he had always sought outside himself. He will then find his reward in an undivided self," unquote. Jung knew this intellectually in 1925 when he wrote it, but he lived it deeply in 1944 when his heart attack provided an experience of profound disintegration even more powerful than his so-called confrontation with the unconscious in 1912. In this somewhat roundabout way, I am suggesting that Jung's shadow problem of his so-called polygamous components was the result of his self-preservational defensive splitting and projecting of the mother and anima dimensions and their subsequent appearances in Emma Rauschenbach on the one side, his maid and his aunt in the middle, and Heli Priceverk, Babette, Sabina Spielrein, Miss Miller, Christiana Morgan, and ultimately Tony Wolfe on the other. The reuniting of these paradoxical and problematic elements was conducted through Jung's fascination with the feminine in her multiplicity, and were at that time imagined by Jung as a concrete polygamous dimension rather than a psychological, symbolic polygamy in service of healing a split imago. Jung's admiration for and fear of the feminine is reflected throughout his written work and offers some insight into the ambivalence with which he is regarded by the women's movement. In one regard, namely his ability to admire women, I think Jung opens the door to anima consciousness for the men who have come after him, and he should be honored for this transforming liberation. In another, though, namely his attempts to translate his experience into theory, Jung oversimplifies and falls prey to assigning gender-specific traits. In this, he imprisons men and women in limited natures that undermine the range of human choices. This brings me to the second section of my comments regarding the aspect of power in Jung's shadow. As I stated earlier, I believe that Jung's attraction to Spielrein and Wolff were compensatory movements by the self, an attempt at healing a damaged wholeness and restoring a sense of the protective immortality of prenatal and early postnatal states. Again, from the essay on marriage, Jung says of the relationship born out of unconsciousness in terms of coupling or marriage or falling in love, and I quote, "Even more is it a return to the mother's womb, into the teeming depths of an as yet unconscious creativity. It is, in truth, a genuine and incontestable experience of the divine, whose transcendent force obliterates and consumes everything individual. A real communion with life and the impersonal power of fate," unquote. This passage eloquently describes that aspect of relationship which Carotenuto quite unerringly characterized as the trap into which Jung fell and into which almost every human being falls. It is the enchanted moment when, like Plato's first human being split apart by Zeus, we think we have discovered the lost half of ourselves, the perfect fit. Jung, despite all his extraordinary powers of perception, succumbed to his own human longing for completion. In his relationships with Emma Jung, Sabina Spielrein, and Tony Wolfe, Jung is a man thrashing about in the convulsions of his own individuation. As Nathan Schwartz-Salant points out in his insightful essay on sexual acting out in analysis, Jung's essay on transference is unusually peppered with moral exhortations and ethical concerns. Clearly, Jung here is keenly aware of his own experience with concretizing the conjunctio. And like the fairy tale figure who warns the hero against opening the forbidden door, he seeks, perhaps too zealously, to protect us from living his ordeal. Motivated by an intense drive to heal his own inner division, Jung, like Pygmalion, or Henry Higgins, like all men, created a woman and fell in love with her. The projection was utterly addictive and compelling. If we imagine the nature of this kind of love as Jung did in his marriage essay, an essay surely informed by this experience, then we can see how easily the abuse of power as an interpersonal event in service of an intrapsychic addiction becomes an inevitable result. You always hurt the one you love, the song goes, describing the intense desire to annex the beloved as the projective self-object that promises eternal bliss. Jung's attempt in his letters to Sabina Spielrein to instruct her in how to love him, blatantly selfish as it was, indicates some dim awareness on his part of what he needed. Tragically for him and for Spielrein, the awareness succumbed to Jung's inability to see it symbolically. When Jung failed to control Spielrein, to compel her to play the precise intrapsychic part which he needed, the spell broke. Spielrein and Jung were propelled into a more fully interpersonal realm, and an ever-widening gulf opened between them. This power shadow was also apparent in Jung's marriage, where he insisted on analyzing his wife as a means of controlling or maintaining her adherence to the status of projection carrier of the number one aspect of the mother. Furthermore, when the relationship with Spielrein was dying, Jung had already begun to enter an even deeper conjunctio with Toni Wolff, and in so doing maintained the precarious balance he had developed in his struggle to survive. It is significant to note also that the three women who occupied such important places in Jung's psyche were all his patients, and Spielrein and Wolff were considerably younger than Jung. Each of these facts points to an element of power, because both the analytic relationship and the discrepancy of ages are archetypally charged with hierarchical qualities. For each of these women, Jung was a wisdom figure, and he seems to have swapped projections with each one as a means of maintaining his relationship to the split feminine. I'd like to make one last point about the power aspect before I briefly take up the theoretical ramifications of the split feminine. And that concerns the sexual assault by a man whom Jung admired, which Jung suffered as a boy. This event had perhaps an even more powerfully shaping effect than Jung's problematic relationship with his mother. This trauma may have shaken Jung's already damaged ability to project the self or to appropriately idealize, especially men, to the point of near non-existence. Only the figure of Freud seems to have held out the possibility of cure. But the issue of authority, or better still, of Freud's refusal to submit to Jung's dominance as his analyst, closed the matter once and for all. But what I'm referring to here is on the journey that Jung and Freud took to America in 1909 to Clark University. Jung and Freud were swapping dreams and sort of analyzing them for each other. And Jung was listening to a dream of Freud's and asked for more information about some of the imagery in the dream. And Freud's response was, "I can't tell you anymore because my authority would be jeopardized." And Jung says this was the moment at which the Freud-Jung relationship began to fall apart, because he felt that Freud's need to hold on to authority was more important than his interest in really trusting someone. So he didn't share the information, and Jung began to drift away from that point on. At least that's how Jung tells the story. Jung's ability to trust and confide in men at least at that point in his life, must have been inhibited by the fear of the repetition of the intense pain created by his fallen father figures. This would have, and I think it did, shift the weight of trust completely onto the women in Jung's life and deepened his need for a number one anima mother. When one considers the touching attempts which both Sabine Spielrein and Emma Jung made on Jung's behalf to halt the demise of the Freud-Jung relationship, they could be understood as failed attempts to help Jung strengthen a precarious psychic balance that might have also freed them from the bondage of Jung's projections and control. In this dimension of his personal life, Jung, for me, becomes a tragic figure, isolated and wounded, enraged and desperate, but most of all hungry for an empathic, loving mirror who would see him as he needed to be seen. Jung also becomes, through this experience as well as others, a full human being whom I welcome as a model, not so much for an aping of his life's events, but as a symbol of faith in the self and the human ability to endure life's alchemy. With this all too brief analysis of the feminine side of Jung's psyche and its interpersonal dimension, I'd like to relate the insights to their theoretical outcome in the anima concept. Jung's split feminine, as I've called it, is clearly reflected in his tendency to assign traits to the anima and by implication to the female gender. Here's a rather blatant example from the marriage essay. I quote, "Even if no woman existed, it would still be possible at any given time to deduce from this unconscious image exactly how a woman would have to be constituted psychically." Unquote. This statement implies that there is a one-for-one correspondence between women and the anima. This is, of course, true of some women in some ways, whom we refer to in the Jungian world as anima woman, because of the tendency to be shaped by identification with male projections. But to claim a woman could be built from a male psyche is another unfortunate version of Adam's rib. Jung vacillated in his theoretical dogmatism regarding the anima, and we can see in his writings where he has glimpses of a clearer vision when he says that the anima, who has been analyzed, disappears as an autonomous personality and becomes a function of relationship between the unconscious and consciousness. The anima here is implied to be not...
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.